Good evening, everyone. I'm Lino Mudu, and welcome to Health Chat. Happy New Year 2018. This is our first show live this year, and I hope you had a great time during the holiday season. Many of us celebrated during the holidays with friends and family around, lots of food and some drinks. Now, for some people, lots of drink meant lots of alcohol. Other people like me, we did on, you know, sodas or juices and everything. Well, the U.S. National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism says 2 to 3 times as many people die on Christmas and New Year's in car crashes caused by alcohol than during comparable periods throughout the rest of the year. So alcohol is often the drink of choice for special occasions, but it is also used regularly by many. Alcohol becomes a problem when people cannot control their consumption to the extent of hurting themselves or those around them. How does one become alcoholic? What are some of the ways to address this problem? These are some of the questions we will try to answer today. And joining us via phone, live from San Diego, California, is Dr. George Koop. He is the director of the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. Dr. Koop, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you so
much. Happy to be here.
Thank you, and Happy New Year to you. Thank you so much for joining us today. Alcohol and alcohol abuse and alcoholism, such a critical topic, especially given the fact that we just walked out of a holiday season with lots of partying and celebration. Now, you are an expert on this topic of alcoholism and many other neurobiology and of addiction and other aspects of this issue. I wanted to ask you first and foremost, what is the difference between alcohol abuse and alcoholism?
Well, we don't really use the term in the United States alcohol abuse anymore because it's been folded into the what we now call alcohol use disorders. And you can have a mild, moderate, or severe case of alcohol use disorder. So if you were to go back to the old terminology, a mild alcohol use disorder would probably be alcohol abuse. This is where you get in trouble with driving with alcohol, maybe some problems at home because of alcohol, but it hasn't evolved into what used to be called substance dependence on alcohol, which is a more severe form of alcohol use disorder.
Okay, so at what point do we talk about alcoholism?
Alcoholism, again, is an old term that's not being used much in diagnosis anymore, but it really refers to substance dependence on alcohol, and that's a more severe form of alcohol use disorder. So you could say alcoholism is equivalent to a severe form of alcohol use disorder.
At what point does one have to become concerned about alcohol consumption? Because some people are social drinkers, and at what point does one become concerned for their loved ones?
Well, we actually use a quantity frequency metric, and that means that, you know, for men, if an individual's drinking, you know, more than 4 drinks in a daytime, or a woman 3 drinks in a daytime in one day, or 7 drinks a week for a woman, or more than 14 drinks a week for a man. Those are flags, red flags that indicate that you may be having an alcohol use disorder problem. The dietary guidelines in the United States are even less. If you want to avoid all the negative consequences of alcohol, the recommendation is 1 drink a day for women and 2 drinks a day for men. And so, you know, it really depends on your genetic makeup and your vulnerability. Obviously, for women, if you have a history of breast cancer in the family, you may not want to drink at all, because there is really no safe amount of alcohol in regards to vulnerability to breast cancer.
Oh, okay. So when you say 1 drink a day for women and 2 drinks a day for men, for those who are healthy, what type of drink are we talking about? Because there are some alcoholic drinks that are stronger than others. I do not drink alcohol, so I'm not very familiar with the different degrees or different types of alcohol. For example, if we're looking at beer or wine or champagne as opposed to vodka, if someone has a drink of vodka, does it equate with a drink of wine, for example?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. Alcohol is alcohol is alcohol. So the way we do it is that we have set up as what's called a standard drink. So a standard drink is 5 ounces of wine, 12 ounces of beer, or 1.5 ounces of a distilled beverage like vodka. That's just arbitrary. Obviously, that can vary a little bit. But there's a really cool website we have that people can find very easily. It's called Rethinking Drinking. And on that website, you can find your favorite drink and how much alcohol is in it. And you can also start to see the relationship between the number of drinks and being intoxicated and blood alcohol levels and all those kind of things.
Oh, that's a very good resource. Thank you for sharing that. And now let me ask you a question that may be a little bit far-fetched, but for the people that like to bake and put some amount of alcohol in their cakes, there's, for example, one cake called rum cake. And this type of approach, is it how much of a concern should it be?
Well, I think if you eat the whole cake, it could be a concern. I honestly don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
I don't know how much actual alcohol is in some of these concoctions. But, you know, if you can smell it, it's usually a warning sign that there's a sufficient amount in there. And if you eat enough of it, you can get intoxicated.
Okay. So now, who is most vulnerable? Is there a specific population that is most vulnerable to alcohol use disorder, alcohol dependency?
Well, there are. I mean, there's a genetic loading, and what that means is that if you have a history of alcohol use disorders, or what we used to call alcoholism, the severe form of alcohol use disorders in your family, you have a fourfold higher likelihood of having an alcohol use disorder yourself. Now, that doesn't mean you're destined to have an alcohol use disorder. It just means that there's a genetic vulnerability there. We're beginning to understand some of the genes that are involved, but it's a bit of a slow slog in that regard on research, because it's becoming very clear there are multiple genes involved. Some involve stress hormones, some involve, you know, the intoxicating effects of alcohol, some involve the metabolism of alcohol. So there is a genetic vulnerability, and then there's also a social vulnerability. So individuals who are abused have gone through a great deal of stress or chronic stress, been in war zones. I mean, any stressors tend to increase the likelihood of an alcohol problem down the line.
So if someone has perhaps a predisposition to becoming dependent on alcohol, what are some of the steps that that person can take to prevent getting to that level where they become dependent on alcohol, whether they went through abuse or there's a genetic predisposition? Are there some steps?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Well, one drastic step that some of my colleagues and friends have used is they just join Al-Anon, which is an organization for individuals with families that histories of alcohol use disorder, and basically they make a pact not to drink at all. And that's certainly one solution. Another solution is that you just monitor your own behavior as best you can, and note that one of the early signs for individuals who have a vulnerability to alcohol use disorders is they're the ones that can drink a lot and not be intoxicated. It sounds paradoxical, but in fact, the person who drinks everybody else under the table is much more vulnerable for an alcohol use disorder than the person who falls asleep at the table after one drink. And this is a phenomenon that has been studied quite a bit, and we intend to follow up on to try and understand the biological basis of it in the near future at the Institute.
Okay. Now, let's talk about the effects of alcohol. We have, I think many of us have this general knowledge that at a certain level of drinking alcohol, it's bad for you, right? We know about car accidents, and perhaps other things, but I think it's very important to go to delve into the effect, whether there are short or long-term effects of alcohol misuse. So would you please enlighten us?
Yeah, so you're absolutely correct. What you just described is the famous J-shaped curve. So low doses of alcohol, 1 to 2 drinks, generally are what we consider social lubricants. They facilitate social interaction. They make people happy. They feel pretty good. They loosen your tongue. I'm sure many, many business deals have been made with during a cocktail hour where somebody has a beer or a mixed drink. And that's there's nothing really a problem there. 70% of Americans at least drink, and very, very few have problems. But when you start going past that 1 to 2 drinks, and you, more importantly, when you get into binge drinking, which is 4 drinks in 2 hours for a female or 5 drinks in 2 hours for a male, then everything goes the other direction. And, you know, this disinhibition that you have and social lubrication where you can interact with people becomes more disinhibition of motor function, of cognitive function. You're likely to say things that are inappropriate. You're likely to do things that are inappropriate. You're likely to act impulsively. When you can't operate heavy machinery like a car very well, you think you can, but you really can't. You have blind spots when you're trying to make quick turns. And then it just gets worse from there. I mean, at some point, you know, I always describe, you know, the person who's kind of slid down the wall and puddled at the bottom of the floor. And, you know, they're conscious, but they're kind of really not very coherent and very, very intoxicated. And then, you know, you keep going and you could end up unconscious. And, you know, the lethal dose of alcohol, you know, is only about 4 times higher than the legal limit. So it can get tricky. And if you mix alcohol with other sedative hypnotic, with other medications, and that's a big concern, especially in the elderly population, then you can make alcohol even more toxic.
Mm. And you talked about the legal limit. Now, let's talk about that. Does it depend on the region where you are, the country where you are? Does each region, each country has its own legal limit, or is there a universal legal limit?
It's universal in the United States at 0.08, which is 80 mg%. But in Europe, the legal limit for driving, I think, is much lower in many countries. And in some countries, you know, zero tolerance. In other words, no alcohol should show up in your bloodstream. I'm not familiar with each individual country, but every country in the world has a different standard in that regard. But I would say most have at least 0.08, which is...
So when we talk about that 0.08, we're talking about the blood alcohol content.
Yeah, it's really 0.08 g%. So it's the grams in 100 milliliters of your blood of alcohol. That's what it is.
Is this gender specific, age specific, or it's across the aisle, for lack of a better term?
Yeah, no, it is. The bigger you are, the less blood alcohol you have for the same amount of drinks. If you're a female, because of distribution of body water in females, they tend to have higher blood alcohols for the same amount of drink for the same weight. But then females generally are smaller anyway, so that's why you see this 4 drinks for females and 5 drinks for males. There really is a gender difference. And so... You know, and then there are individual differences based on genetic issues. You know, Asians, about 30 to 40% of them are missing one of the genes for metabolism of alcohol, and as a result, they can't tolerate much alcohol at all.
Okay. Now, we just came out of the holidays. Some people may continue to celebrate this week, and one of the issues is when people go to parties, they drink. So can you give us some tips, even though the holidays is over, but we are social human beings, so we go to parties. It's not just over the holidays. Could you give us some tips for responsible party drinking? But also I wanted to have your take on party hosting. The role of the host, during a party, and how the host can help in that, in the sense that, you know, it can contribute to helping people not go over the drinking limit as well.
Yes, and so we recommend three things. So one is, don't drink on an empty stomach. Usually it's a good idea to have food, even if it's just some kind of snacks, healthy snacks, not healthy snacks for that matter. Anything that goes on your stomach is actually going to blunt the absorption of alcohol and prevent you from getting really tipsy really fast. The second is to pace your drinking. So have water in between. It'll help you avoid a hangover. It'll help you pace your drink, so maybe you'll have sparkling water in between a drink, and it'll slow you down, and it'll slow down the absorption as a result. And then the final one for the individual is don't drive. I mean, have somebody else be a designated driver, take a taxi or Uber or some other Lyft. You know, it doesn't matter what kind of facility you use. And then the responsibility of the host would be to loop back to those first two items. So the host should, you know, really provide food so that people don't get, you know, if you start drinking on an empty stomach, you're going to get very intoxicated very quickly. And it's been known for, you know, 100 years that food on the stomach blunts the absorption of alcohol. And then, you know, provide alternate beverages. I think that's a responsibility of a host. You know, it could be anything from Diet Cokes to sparkling water to just plain water, you know.
Okay. All right. And before we're going to take a break and continue our conversation with Dr. Koop, we have some very, very interesting tips here. And I think that it's not just for the holidays, but it's for every day for those people who like to drink alcohol, then there's nothing wrong, I guess, with drinking alcohol, but it's how you drink it and how much you drink it. So, Dr. Koop, we will be right back. Don't go away. We have to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
Hello. This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
What's up, Africa? I'm Jackson Vunganya in Washington.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America.
Listen, we need to discuss what's going on in your communities, issues that affect you.
Are you involved?
Are you engaged in transforming your society?
Today, right now, this is your platform.
Let us know what you've been up to.
Check us out on Facebook. Drop us a line.
It's Upfront Wednesdays at 1730 UTC
right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Welcome back. For those of you joining us late, tonight's topic on Health Chat is alcohol. Joining us via phone from San Diego, California, is Dr. George Koop. He's a director of the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. Now, Dr. Koop, we wanted to know some of the terms that are being used. We hear very often, frequently, with alcohol. For example, a hangover. What is a hangover?
Well, I think of a hangover as a mini withdrawal syndrome. So this is a phenomenon that where your body has been reacting to the alcohol, and the alcohol's gone, and now the reaction to the alcohol is what shows up. So a good example is that, alcohol make you sleepy. You may go to bed and fall asleep fairly readily, but 3 or 4 hours later you wake up, you have to go to the bathroom and pee or something of that nature, and then you're wide awake and your head is spinning and you're hyper excitable, and then a headache will come on, and that is in fact a kind of mini withdrawal syndrome that is caused by the removal of the alcohol. And so your body fights the alcohol's effect if you overdo it, and there is that fighting back. It stays around for several hours, can be even longer when you stop drinking.
Okay. And what about an alcohol overdose? What is a regular dose and what is an overdose?
Well, an overdose of alcohol would be where you're... there are two definitions. One definition would be where you've drunk more than you intended, and so you have, in a sense, gone over the dose that you intended and perhaps got too intoxicated. But, death due to alcohol, where it would be charted as an overdose death in a hospital setting, usually occurs when you've drunk about 4 to 5 times the legal limit, which is, and so you get to a blood alcohol level of 0.3, 0.4, 0.5 gram percent. That's a lethal dose.
Wow. So there is a level where people can die from alcohol, but are there some warning signs to perhaps indicate that they are gone too far before they take the fatal drink?
Yes. Yeah. Someone who's really become, like I said, incoherent and slurring their words and in an emotional state where they vary between being depressed and being hyper happy, and we call that emotional lability. And that stage is the first warning. The second warning is when somebody goes unconscious, and then they really probably should be taken to the emergency room. And because even if you think they're just sleeping it off, the problem is, if you can't wake them up, they could vomit and actually choke on their own vomit, and it's a serious condition. And there have been a number of incidents in the United States where individuals weren't taken to the emergency room and then they died. So, if you're unconscious and the person is unresponsive, that's a big warning sign that you're in a danger zone.
And it's. I was going to ask you actually, what should people do? People that are around someone who is going through those stages. You said if they are unconscious to go to the emergency room, but if they are not unconscious yet, but they are at that level that you described, where they are very happy and depressed and that very...
Well,
confused.
That's when they should stop drinking. I mean, that's basically... And someone should try to hydrate them if they can, get them some water in them. If they start to become completely obtunded, in other words, they don't respond to stimuli, then they probably need to go to the doctors the hospital. Because you got to keep the airways clear. I mean, you're basically dealing with a life-threatening situation.
Mm. Now, there are some misconceptions about alcohol, and you addressed that also. Can you share with us some of those misconceptions?
Well, a lot of people think alcohol is a stimulant, and it's largely a depressant and produces disinhibition. And so, one of the worries, as I mentioned earlier, is that, if you're taking medications that also are sedative, there can be a severe interaction with alcohol. I think so. One misconception is that alcohol is always a stimulant. It's going to make you intoxicated in a positive way. I think the other is that more is better. We know that with almost all drugs that affect the brain, more is not better. More is actually worse in many cases. Mm-hmm. And so, we talked about the J-shaped curve and that I think the other is another misconception as well. You drink coffee and you can be immediately cured of your intoxication and everything's fine.
Yeah.
And the problem with that is that coffee gives you superficially a feeling of being alert, but when the coffee wears off, then you have a double whammy. You have the coffee wearing off, which can produce sedation, and then you have the alcohol sedation. And if you're driving under those conditions, you know, can be very serious because you fall asleep.
Mm.
So those are some of the issues. Another one is that alcohol makes you warm, so you should drink it in the cold, and that's not true. You get the sensation of warming because you get peripheral dilation, but actually it can make your inner body temperature colder, so it's not a good idea. I mean, as colorful as it is of a St. Bernard dog delivering alcohol to you while you're stuck in a snowdrift, not a good idea.
Okay. Now, the World Health Organization says that alcohol increasingly is affecting younger generations and drinkers in developing countries. Is this trend being observed as well in the developed world, for example, in the United States?
There's actually good news in the United States, which is that young people under 21 in high school age, middle school age, are drinking less, and it's been a steady decline over the last 10 years. The bad news in the United States is young people between 20 and 30 years old are engaged in what we call extreme binge drinking, and these are individuals doing 10, 15 drinks in an evening. And that's really pushing the envelope, as we've discussed, because you're getting close to doses that can, you know, make you unconscious or even be lethal, depending on how fast and furious you're doing the drinking. So those are the trends we see, and depending on how you define young people. For me, anybody under 30 is still quite a young person.
That's right. So, Dr. Kube, let's say someone wants to stop drinking, but we hear how addictive alcohol is, and they don't know what to do. They just can't stop. Where do they start?
Well, I think we just launched something that's mostly generic for Americans, but it's called the Treatment Navigator. But it would be worthwhile anyone looking at it, because that gives you the full description of what an alcohol use disorder is, what kind of treatments are available, and there are many. They range from, you know, a 28-day detox all the way to, you know, certified counselors who are trained in helping people even with a mild alcohol use disorder, and Alcoholics Anonymous, for example, self-help groups and so forth. It's all in the Treatment Navigator. They tell you all about it.
Okay.
But they also list the questions you should ask if you need to seek treatment. What questions should you ask from a good treatment program and issues such as that. I mean, if you've already been through that and you're going to a party and you don't want to drink, but everybody else is going to be drinking, then, you know, you adopt some cognitive behavioral strategies that are often used by counselors, which is, you know, you get yourself a glass of Perrier, you put a lime in it, and you enjoy your drink of non-alcoholic drink and have a good time just like everybody else.
Yes, something I do personally. Well, Dr. Kube, thank you so much for joining us. We have to leave there. We appreciate your time.
You're most welcome. And Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you again. And that's all the time we have for this edition of Health Chat. We thank our guest, Dr. George Kube. He's the director of the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. And thanks to all of you for joining us today, all our affiliates in Africa. We thank you. If you want to know more about today's show, log on to our website at voanews.com/healthchat. And you can also check the Institute's website at niaaa.nih.gov. And I'm your host, Lina Mudu, in Washington, with producer Ian Bihar. Until next time, take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy day.